Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. We've got a lot coming your way in the next half hour, including an excerpt from a spectacular edition of A Country Ramble from last Sunday night, when longtime WISO music hosts Tom Duffy and Fred Bartenstein spent 2 hours reminiscing and reflecting back 90 years on the birth of commercial country music. It all happened when the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers got together for a series of recording sessions in Bristol, Virginia. It was known as the Bristol Sessions, and you're going to hear as much of that audio as we can play for you today. Up first, this summer, we're bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. Today, we meet Daryl Dean, who works at a disability services organization in Dayton. As WISO's April Leslie explains, at first, Daryl struggled to find a job after he graduated from high school.
Daryl Dean refuses to get upset about the little things.
I don't know where my attitude comes. I just got a good attitude all around. I know I do get down sometimes, but mostly I'm up.
The 45-year-old was born with spina bifida and hydrocephalus, conditions that can cause paralysis and neurological issues. He's had several surgeries and faced a lot of medical problems because of his disability, but he says he's mostly come to terms with it. He says his large family is one reason for that. They never made him feel different.
There's nothing I can do about my disability, you know. I've got it, you know. So, I have to live with it, you know. It doesn't bother me or anything. I just cope with it and go on.
Daryl says he never saw his disability as a barrier to his success until he graduated from high school and started looking for a job.
It was tough because I know I went to like 3 different places to interview, and the one place that I interviewed, I had a job coach, and the guy that was interviewing me was asking my job coach the questions and not me. And she's like, he's right there. If you want to ask him something, ask him something. Ask him a question. People are nervous, and I can understand that. They just don't want to ask questions that, you know, they feel like if they ask, what will you say or what will your reaction be? And
Daryl uses a wheelchair to get around, and he has extra fluid around his brain, causing his head to be enlarged. He says some people stare at him rather than talk to him.
And that really bugs me when they do that, and they don't ask questions. Be straight up with me. You know, if you got a question, ask me. Don't just stare or anything like that. Just ask, and I can answer it the best to my knowledge.
He eventually did get a job, one at McDonald's, which he loved. He worked there for 6 years until medical issues forced him to take time off. Now, Daryl works at United Rehabilitation Services, a day program for adults and children with disabilities. He says it's made him feel like he's part of a community that understands him. He's been there for over 10 years now, and he says he still looks forward to work every day. Daryl lives with his sister, but he wants to live on his own someday, or with a significant other. That idea scares him a little bit. He's hopeful it'll happen, but for now, he's leaving it up to fate.
I'm hoping it will, but we'll wait and see down the road.
You seem like the type of guy that just sort of like, it happens or it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I am. If it happens, it happens. If it don't, it don't. You know, what can you do?
That was Daryl Dean. We were introduced to him by his colleagues at United Rehabilitation Services. When he's not working, Daryl's in a bowling club. His average is 120. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
You've been listening to a story from our series, Just Ask, talking about disabilities. What questions do you have for Daryl Dean? Tell us by going to WYSO.org. That's also where you can learn more about the series. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. Up next on Why So Curious, we tackle a question asked by Talis Gaja.
Why don't more black people become police officers?
Why So Curious looked into the numbers and found that Dayton has a disproportionately small number of African-American officers. The city is 43% black, but only 8% of law enforcement is black. According to a USA Today investigation into 2010 census data, Dayton had the biggest racial gap in the country. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds has found that the gap hasn't changed much since that time.
It's Friday morning at a restaurant on North Main Street in Dayton. It's called Benjamin's the Burger Master, and it's known for its burgers and chicken. But today, they also have free coffee and donuts. The Dayton police are holding an event here called Coffee with a Cop. They do it a couple times a month at different locations, and it gives community members a chance to ask police questions. One of the cops is Major Eric Henderson, an African-American officer who saw law enforcement as a positive influence at an early age.
To be quite honest, my first exposure with the Dayton Police Department was when I was in high school, and it was during the DARE program. An officer came and picked me up in a cruiser. So the first time I'm in a cruiser, I'm riding in the front seat.
Henderson says that type of exposure to police is one of the keys to getting more black recruits.
It's important to have positive interactions and non-enforcement. So it's important that, you know, we're out in events like this, and that we also try to get a little bit more involved in schools and the neighborhood activities.
Thomas Reed came today with his neighborhood association to show support for the Dayton police. Seeing officers in his neighborhood makes him feel safe. But when he was young, he never would have considered becoming an officer.
I don't know about younger kids, but people my age, I'm 62. I've had a few instances with the police where, you know, I had one stop me on the highway and he thought I was kidnapping my white wife. And so, you know.
So Reed is black, his wife is white, and the officer stops him on 75.
He pulled me out of the car. I guess he thought, you know, I actually was kidnapping her, and pulled me over to the side, and we had the conversation. It was kind of weird.
Dr. Marlies Durr is a sociologist at Wright State. She says those types of experiences stick with people and get passed down. After the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Durr wrote an article titled, "What is the Difference Between Slave Patrols and Modern Day Policing?" She says it's hard for many African Americans to even imagine being law enforcement.
If you do the comparison between slavery and contemporary times, they indeed would be the overseer. They would be watching their communities. They would be the ones to keep those people, so to speak, in line.
Durr says that becoming a police officer was once a major accomplishment in black communities all over the country. But she says post-civil rights and post-affirmative action, young African Americans have more options. And with high-profile police shootings in the news, many feel they would become targets if they join law enforcement.
Recently, it has begun to feel like they would be attacked the same way white cops are being attacked, simply because they wear blue.
Durr says police can build better relationships with the black community by connecting with children at a young age, by the time they're 9 or 10. And that's just what the Dayton PD has been trying to do. They have officers that read to students, play basketball with them, eat lunch at their schools. They even have an ice cream truck that goes around giving out free ice cream. Still, it's a slow process with so much history to overcome. Assistant Chief Mark Ecton has recruiting responsibilities, and he says the police can't do it alone.
It's going to take a community effort to change the narrative. We can go out and we can talk to young people and get them excited about joining our department or any other department. And then when they go home, they have someone who talks to them about their experiences with police and then talk them out of it.
Ecton, who is African American, knows that many Daytonians have serious concerns about policing, and he's asking those people to step up.
I challenge people in the community who are unhappy with the state of law enforcement today to either join or identify someone who you believe would make a good police officer. You know, there is a need for change, and the only way to make change is to be in the room.
Last year, 32 new recruits graduated from the police academy. 5 of them were African American. That's 16%, which is an improvement. But it's going to be a long time before the Dayton police accurately reflect the Dayton population. For Why So Curious, I'm Jason Reynolds.
For links to Dayton Police demographics and recruiting materials, visit WISO.org. Why So Curious is sponsored by Proto Build Bar, a proud supporter of Curious Minds. Last Sunday evening on A Country Ramble, longtime WISO music host Tom Duffy and Fred Bartenstein spent 2 hours remembering an historic occasion 90 years ago, considered by most to mark the birth of commercial country music. It all happened when the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers got together for a series of recording sessions in Bristol, Virginia. They are known as the Bristol Sessions, and we're going to dedicate the rest of today's program to a portion of the WISO original broadcast from last Sunday. From A Country Ramble, here's Tom Duffy, Fred Bartenstein, and the Bristol Sessions.
I never could win a Benny under the weeping willow, yes, under the weeping willow tree.
There's the Carter family from 1927. As I was saying to Fred, very vigorous music, wonderful vocals, harmony. Maybell with a fully developed guitar style. That in To start us out tonight, talking about the Bristol Sessions, as I mentioned before, in those hot July and August days in 1927, there was an outreach from the Victor Record Company. They went remote. They took their recording equipment to a storefront, a building in Bristol, to record local talent. And Fred Bartenstein, I understand that this outreach from the record company was part of a larger outreach by many record companies at the time to record rural music.
Well, the recording technology started in the late 19th century, and the first markets for records were the urban markets, where classical music and pop music of the time was played. And somebody had the brilliant idea that there might be other markets. And it started out by being places like Europe or the British Isles or the Far East. And then somebody made another brilliant observation that maybe there are people in the United States who don't partake of the mass culture who might want to buy records. So African Americans, rural whites, and Hispanic populations, the French Canadians in Louisiana, and the recording companies experimented with this market. And in some cases, these musicians would get on a train and go up to New York and record there. And then other times, the recording companies would pack up the equipment. Huge mechanical equipment, must have taken most of a truck, and taken them out to not rural communities, because rural communities didn't have sufficient electricity or buildings that could be isolated enough to make a good recording. But they'd go to a town the size of maybe Bristol or Atlanta or Winston-Salem or San Antonio, and would advertise in the local papers and say, if you make music and would like to make a record, we're going to be in town next weekend. And people could come and sign up, like amateur hour, and audition and make a record. These weren't long, drawn-out processes. Like, the Carter family recorded that in one take, mm-hmm. with everybody mm-hmm. in front of one microphone. And nobody knew whether it would work or not. But these records started to sell, the first one being, of course, the Gid Tanner record, Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane from 19...
John Carson.
Fiddlin' John Carson, yeah. You're right, mm-hmm. in 1923.
Right.
And that wasn't the first country music that had ever been recorded, but it was the first one that sold a lot of copies. It sold enough that the industry saw that this was had some potential. Well, we should mention that the term country music hadn't been invented.
There was no such thing as country music. We would still even classify this today perhaps as folk music. Is that – how would you call it? Rural music?
This is one of the fun parts of studying early recordings, is that there were so many terms that were used.
Old familiar tunes
was used, old familiar tunes, mountain music. The term hillbilly music came from 1925, when a band of North Carolinians and Virginians went to New York to record, and the recording engineer asked them, what would you like to be called? And they said, well, we're nothing but a bunch of hillbillies. So they wrote the hillbillies down, and that was the first time that the term hillbilly was used to describe music. But that became the primary term until the 1940s, when Ernest Tubb and Red Foley and some folks decided that hillbilly was a negative term and we needed to change it. And that's when we went to country.
Well, if this Fiddlin' John Carson recorded in 1923, and you said the hillbillies recorded in 1925, that means this kind of music was at least 4 years old when the Bristol Sessions occurred in 1927.
That's right. And there'd been these distant recording sessions mm-hmm. done, maybe 10 or 20 of them by then.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the Bristol Sessions as referred to as the Big Bang of country music.
You know, Nolan Porterfield wrote a biography of Jimmy Rogers. I should say the biography of Jimmy Rogers. And he coined that term. And it's been debated a lot since. And then Bristol, Virginia, Tennessee has got what's called the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, which is even more controversial because clearly Bristol was not the birthplace of country music. Country music grew up in multiple places. But this notion of the Big Bang, since you announced the show tonight, I've been thinking about it and decided that a more apt analogy would be that the Bristol Sessions were the butterfly wing that started mm-hmm. the tsunami. Mm-hmm. Because Big Bang is something that everybody would know about, mm-hmm. and it would have made a big impression on the public. And the Bristol Sessions did not make a big impression on the public in 1927. It's only in retrospect that we realize how important they were. Because two of the most seminal, most major commercial country music acts, the progenitors that we now look back to, the Carter Family and Jimmy Rogers, happened by coincidence to have been on the roster for those sessions. And so looking backwards, we can say that the country music industry really does trace to that event, although no participant in it that day knew it would or intended for it to be, nor for 10 or 15 years was it even considered as an important historical event.
And so as part of that, as you mentioned, the Jimmy Rogers and the Carter Family, let's hear another from the Carter Family. They recorded 6 songs that day. And the one we just heard, Bury Me Underneath the Weeping Willow, was the very first cut they recorded. They came back the next morning, at least the two women did, Sarah
right.
and Maybelle.
AP was Sarah's husband and Maybelle's brother and cousin-in-law. And he was trying to fix the tire on the car so that they could get home to Mesa Springs, Virginia. Because the tire had blown several times on the way over and it had been patched inexpertly. So he was off getting the tire fixed, and Maybelle and Sarah went into the studio and recorded the second day.
And this song, Single Girl, Married Girl.
Yeah, Sarah didn't want to record it. She hated it and said that she didn't like the idea of a song that was complaining. And but Ralph Peer, who was the producer of the session, said, Sarah, that's the song. And so against her will, against her better judgment, she recorded it. And sure enough, that was the cut that sold.
Let's hear it. Single Girl, Married Girl from the Carter Family on that August day, 1927.
Single girl, she's going dressed.
Ernest Stoneman, Pop Stoneman, from the Bristol Sessions, 1927. Fred Bartenstein in the studio with us tonight here on WYSO, A Country Ramble. Thanks for coming in, Fred. Our resident expert, our country music historian, an instructor, a professor at University of Dayton, where he teaches country music. Fred, Pop Stoneman was integral to this process.
Yeah, Pop Stoneman, E.V., was a mill worker who lived in the Galax, Virginia, Freeze, Virginia area, and had early on become an entrepreneur using his musical talent to try and get beyond what he could make as what used to be called a lint head in the cotton mills, and had gone up to New York and successfully recorded for several different recording companies. He would change his name and appear under one name for one company and another name for another company. They used to pay, I think it was $25 for a record. There were no royalties or anything. And so to make the trip worthwhile, he would record as much as he could. So he was the experienced hand at recording. And when Ralph Peer was coming down to that area near where Pop Stoneman lived, Ralph asked him to help organize the musicians in the area to come into the studio. And some of them knew of E.B. Stoneman's ability, the magical ability to turn music into money, something that people weren't doing at the time. Music was for enjoyment, for front porches, for frolics, for dances, but and maybe for playing at courthouse in front of courthouses for nickels and dimes on the street, but it wasn't something that you could do as an alternative to real work.
And Fred, it's fascinating to listen to these Bristol sessions because we are hearing music, we'll call it country music, before it became a stage music. This is indeed that music you're referring to. And we refer to him as Pop Stoneman for a reason. Why is it the Fred?
How many kids did he have? Some huge number, 15 or
16
children,
yes,
including what we know today as the Stoneman family that had a television show for a while. And Scotty Stoneman, the amazingly talented fiddler, was one of his children. Ronnie Stoneman, who was Ida Nagger on Hee Haw, was one of his kids. And he really did create a 50-year legacy in music with these progeny. He moved them from Galax, Virginia, up to the Washington, D.C. area and lived in a very poor suburban neighborhood of Washington called Carmody Heights, in which they lived in a shack with not even a wood floor, in amazing poverty, trying to keep the family alive, playing in Washington, D.C. At different venues. And so Pop Stoneman not only was a pioneer recording artist, but he is one of the first figures to make country music popular in the Washington, D.C. region.
And so in these Bristol sessions, we're hearing that Pop Stoneman in that transition is still a mill worker, but he's decided he wants to make his living playing music.
Right. And this is the big transition, this, as we say, the butterfly wing that starts the tsunami. The idea that because radio has been invented and because phonograph records are invented and because we have the flivvers, the Model Ts, they aren't great roads, but at least you can cover an area wider than your holler and your neighborhood to go out and perform for larger audiences who might hear you on the radio, it suddenly becomes possible for people to escape a life of agricultural or industrial drudgery. It's no surprise that many of the early musicians had names like Peg Leg or Blind Alfred. If you were impaired and not able to do hard manual labor, music was a good alternative.
I see something else in these 1927 sessions, Fred, and that's the strong presence of women in this musical sampling. We heard from Sarah and Maybelle Carter. Pop Stoneman's wife played the violin. She played the fiddle. She was a fiddle player. And on this next cut, essentially a neighbor of Pop's, he brought a lot of people into this session. He was the impresario under the tutelage of Ralph Peer. But his wife is playing fiddle on here. And what strikes me is that young country music industry that is about to be developed would not permit women to be on the stage. That just wasn't a role.
Well, if women performed, it had to be done within a family context, because a woman who performed as a solo artist or on her own, entertainers and prostitutes were commingled in the public mind at that time. It was a very risque kind of a profession, being a barroom singer. So you'll notice that for the first 30 years or so of country music, either the person is performing with their family members, with their husbands, with their brothers and sisters, or pretending that they are related to another member of the band, which was a strategy that Roy Acuff used.
I agree with you, everything you said, Fred. But here we have women in their natural setting, sort of moved from the home where they did play the banjo, they did play the violin, they played the fiddle. And since this is a sampling of sort of homemade music, we get the strong presence of women.
And let's bring that out, too, because we think today of the guitar as a man's instrument. And in the 19th century, the guitar was a woman's instrument, and it was a middle or upper class instrument that refined women played in the parlor. So if you were going to have guitar music in those early days or learn guitar music, chances are you were learning it from your mother or your grandmother. So it was perfectly natural that Sarah and Maybelle were the instrumental musicians in those days. Fiddlers were more often male, but not, as you've said, not entirely male. But the guitar, the early use of the guitar in mountain music was a female phenomenon. And lots of these, the material, you played the Dying Girl's Farewell, that was a song that women would play and sing in the parlors before television, before radio was invented, typically from sheet music, maybe at the piano or with a guitar accompaniment, these sentimental tunes, Victorian tunes that were composed on Tin Pan Alley in New York City.
Well, let's move to this children's song now, this play song for youths. From Hattie Stoneman, Pop's wife, and a neighbor, Eck Dunford. It's the, you all know this, is the children's song, Skip to My Lou.
Yonder she comes, and how do you do? Yonder she comes, skip to my Lou. Yonder she comes, and how do you do? Skip to my Lou, my darling. You've got money, and I have too. You've got money, skip to my Lou. You've got money, and I have too. Skip to my Lou, my darling. All around the house in the pig pen too. All around the house, skip to my Lou. All around the house in the pig pen too. Skip to my Lou, my darling.
As we take out our show tonight on the Bristol Sessions, thank you so much for lending us your expertise, Fred Bartenstein, and good luck on your publishing efforts. You are going to feature your book at both Galax Festival this next week.
Right.
And you have an appearance at the Blue Ridge.
At the Blue Ridge Music Center, the Friday of Labor Day weekend, the show for Joe up on the Blue Ridge Parkway. And then we're going to do an event the next day at Mountain City, which is where the original Big Fiddlers Convention was held.
Fred Bartenstein, author of Lucky Joe's Namesake, The Extraordinary Life and Observations of Joe Wilson. Thank you, Fred, so very much. A remarkable banjo player from Corbin, Kentucky.
Oh, man, this is great. You have to do a show on B.F. Shelton, an entire show.
I'm planning it right now.
Okay. Thank you.
She went off before there she was she could find. She went off before there she was she could find a new dull grave and a straight line by.
That was an excerpt from last Sunday's A Country Ramble featuring Tom Duffy and Fred Bartenstein and their reflections of the Bristol Sessions with the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers and the birth of commercial country music. You can hear more old-time country music tonight with Tom Duffy at 6 o'clock on WISO. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on Why So? It's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.